Accession number 12907.
Mr. Bashford, reel three.
So one, we spent most of the first 2 or 3 weeks in infantry support role. That is, the infantry would be a bit in front of us and we would be a bit behind them in case they were going to be subject to a German counterattack. So the first few weeks were not dreadfully unpleasant. One had enough to eat, one could get out and do the bodily functions. You could even shave most mornings. But then, after the first few weeks there, I've mentioned the transfer when the 3rd and 4th County London Yeomanry were amalgamated, and I then joined what was the 44th Royal Tank Regiment, was interviewed by the Colonel Hopkinson in an orchard, and assigned to be the gunner on troop leader's tank of A Squadron. And the troop leader was Tony Gallagher. Now, there was a very well-known communist MP in Parliament at the start of war, Willie Gallagher, the only communist MP at that time from Glasgow. And Willie Gallagher had two adopted sons. His eldest son was in Bomber Command, I think, and he was lost over Germany. His youngest adopted son, Tony Gallagher, who was 21, was our troop leader at the time. He was rather fortunate because, for some reason, he switched me off his tank into the troop sergeant's tank. And this, in fact, is rather jumping a bit from the early days of Normandy across the Battle of Falaise. But it just comes to mind at that time that at the Battle of Falaise, when by chance I had been moved out of Tony Gallagher's tank, in the push towards closing the Falaise gap, Tony Gallagher's tank was hit, unfortunately, and he was killed before, in fact, the Falaise gap was closed.
What kind of a chap was he?
He was young, obviously, at 21, and slight. And I think because the people or the crews knew that his father was a communist, they had a great sympathy for him. There's a great sympathy amongst the fighting troops for the Russian people, actually. In fact, there was a lot of, obviously, communist sympathy, and the fact that Tony Gallagher was the son of Willie Gallagher, he was held in quite high esteem.
Did he seem to be political at all? Did he ever mention politics?
Not that I'm aware of, no. No.
So you're in this new unit, and how did you feel about it?
The 44th Royal Tank, well, it was quite good actually, because the Royal Tank Regiment thinks that it is the real heart of the Royal Armoured Corps, and of course the Royal Tank Regiment has this long tradition of being the first to develop tank theory and tank warfare. And the 44th Royal Tank Regiment was a very good regiment because it was a territorial unit from Bristol. And a lot of them knew each other. I mean, they had a lot of new intake, obviously, like myself. But there was a very keen spirit there, and the commanding officer, Jerry Hopkinson, went on eventually to become the Colonel Commandant of the Royal Armoured Corps. So there was a spirit of the Royal Tank Regiment, and in the early days in Normandy, when Brigadier Mike Carver, who was the Colonel Commandant of 1st RTR, was made Brigadier of the 4th Armoured Brigade, that rather meant that because the Brigadier was a member of the Royal Tank Regiment and the commanding officer of the 44th was a member of the Royal Tank Regiment, it seemed to us in the 44th that we always got picked in the 4th Armoured Brigade for the more knottier, problems. And of course, Mike Carver then went on to become Field Marshal Lord Carver. And of course, one has a great respect for him because he was a very thinking soldier. So the 44th Royal Tank Regiment was switched, as was the 4th Armoured Brigade, because the 4th Armoured Brigade was in an independent role and was put in to support whichever part of the army needed extra armoured support. So we were switched from left to right flank of the Normandy campaign, I wouldn't say frequently, but at least twice, on tank transporters that again impressed me with the efficiency and the planning operations of what was going on. It was the greatest surprise of my life when we leagued in the field and 12 hours later these enormous tank transporters came in and we put ourselves on the tank transporters and they took us about 60 miles across to the other flank. I thought it was an amazing bit of organisation.
So can you now pick up the narrative again after you joined 44 RTR?
Well, 44 RTR, we had a rather sticky situation around what was called Hill 112, which is well known, I think, amongst the Normandy campaigners. So we had to go at Hill 112, as a lot of other people had to go at Hill 112. We crossed the Oden once, they had to come back again because we couldn't hold it.
Can you tell me about the attempt on 112, please, as you remember it?
It was this intense mortar and artillery. When I say intense, of course, it's all relative. It seemed intense to me at the time. It seemed too intense to all of them. Of course, it's nothing compared to some of the artillery barrages that the Germans had to suffer. But the Hill 112 position, we were simply holding it against the German fairly determined efforts to take it. And Hill 112 was where you went forward in a holding position, in a hold-down position, to keep observation of the skyline. But again, you couldn't move out of the tank. You were there for long periods of time. You couldn't close down the tank. And this is where the German Nebelwerfers had a rather devastating effect. The German Nebelwerfers were 9-barrel mortars which had sirens on the fins, so that as they came in on their descent, the sirens rather, not siren, but it was a device that made a whistling noise. So you had this dreadful whistling noise that seemed to get nearer and nearer. And sitting inside the tank, you became convinced that the next Nebelwerfer was going to come right through the turret hatch and land inside the tank. But you couldn't close down the hatch, really, because it made you were completely blind. Relatively, the crew commander couldn't really see. So you suffered with the hatch open, but these dreadful Minnewerfers that were really quite demoralising and were quite devastatingly effective, actually.
Were they Nebelwerfers or Minnenwerfers?
Nebelwerfers. So one felt desperately sorry for any infantry who were outside in slit trenches and weren't. Because you're right inside the tank with a Nebelwerfer, even if it landed on the outside, you'd be right on the inside. But the poor infantry who had no other recourse than to dig deeper and deeper, one felt intensely sorry for. So that was a period of boredom and anxiety mixed together, where you were rationing your cigarettes and your boiled sweets to last out. Nobody was very keen on eating, so you had a tin of corned beef that you nibbled at from time to time and dried biscuits. But eventually you pulled back because somebody else was going to relieve you and have a go. We had various attempts to engage German self-propelled guns, but you could never see them, and they always managed to get one of you before you could even realise that they were there.
What so, about this action in relation to this river, you said?
Crossing the Odon.
Was this part of the closing of the Falaise Gap?
No, this was before the Falaise Gap. This was one of the pushes to get round the south of Caen. Caen itself was very difficult, as we know, to take, and suffered dreadfully. We had one period where we were on the edge of Carpiquet Aerodrome, which is a bit to the west of Caen, again, simply a defensive holding position, until, I forget the name of the operation, it was Operation Epsom, I think. Operation Epsom was launched, that was a drive south of Caen to come round south. But where, having got across the River Odon, we couldn't sustain it, and we were withdrawn. Well, I say we, I mean the general army front. One gets a very curiously tunnel vision on this, because you think that everything's going on, that you and the person, the other person in the tank, are the only ones involved. Of course, there's a long front of a mile or so, and there's hundreds of other people involved. But in general, you don't, again, always, we don't know what's going on inside the tank. You know that ahead of you is the German, who you always treated with the greatest of respect, but you never knew what was going on to the left or the right of you. So over the 19 step would come an order that Sunray decides we shall pull back. Another curious situation in those days was that the wireless communication had to be disguised, that is, because of the fear that German monitoring could pick up inter-tank communication and discern what's going on. People speaking over the 19 set frequency had to use guarded language so that they wouldn't say, well, the commanding officer decided that A squadron will pull back. They would say, well, Sunray has said that the boys ought to consider a jaunt to so-and-so. Now, a jaunt meant really pulling back, but when the crew command or the squadron leader looked at it, he knew that you were pulling back. So, but when you're sitting in the gunner's seat and you weren't on the outside net, you were only on the inner tank communication, it came as a bit of a relief when, in fact, the crew commander would say, righto, driver, we're going to pull back, and that was on the inner set, which couldn't be picked up. So it's always a sense of great relief when you realise that things hadn't gone so well, presumably, and that you were going to be pulled back, and at least you were going to have the next few days without that sense of apprehension.
And Sunray is the code name for the commanding officer?
Usually, yes. Or Sunray can be applied to any local commanding level. So, in fact, Sunray can even apply to the troop leader. So this concealed language used to get a bit esoteric at times, because the message will come, well, Sunray thinks you should pull back your long thing. And the long thing was the reference to the Sherman Firefly tank, which had a 17-pound on it. Most troops of tanks had four tanks, the troop. Three tanks were Shermans with a 75mm moderate low velocity gun, the normal Sherman. The fourth Sherman was what we called a Firefly, and that had the upgun 17-pounder. But if that had to be moved, because the 17-pounder usually lay back. The other three tanks were forward, the 17-pounder lay back. And that was because the Germans would, if they had any choice, would pick off the 17-pounder first before they tried to pick off any other tank, because the 17-pounder was the only one which could take on Panthers and Tigers with any reasonable chance of penetrating them. So if the 17 pounder had to be moved, then the message would come up, oh, Sunray thinks your long thing should be pulled back. This would not allow the Germans to know that the Firefly was being moved or Fireflies were being put somewhere else. So there are all sorts of funny expressions coming over the radio, which caused a lot of amusement as well as a lot of puzzlement at times.
Just a local code?
Just a local inbuilt regimental code. Mm-hmm. So we assume it foxed any German listening in station. And of course you never ever refer to units by name, number, or even mentioned anybody's name. So hence the term Sunray. And sometimes it was Sunray 1, who was the commanding officer, Sunray 2, or Sunray 2 Able, who was the squadron commander, major squadron commander. Sunray 3 and 4 will come down to lieutenants in command of troops. So there's a lot of coded language that people brought in, and sometimes it got so esoteric that the message was never understood. But the radio communication network, I always thought, was very efficient. The 19 set network had a fairly good range. Sometimes it wasn't always good reception, but inter tank and inter troop communication was very good. It was good when when you had situations where a leading troop would be nosing forward but would lose maybe its first two tanks because of a German armoured fighting vehicle in a concealed position, but where hopefully the troop leader has some idea where it was. And if he thought it was concealed on the edge or near of a wood, for instance, he would pass a message back on the 19 set to squadron leader to invoke the help of the 2nd Tactical Air Force. They were the Typhoons. And if there's one thing that we took great heart in seeing was Typhoons coming over and circling and loosing their rockets, and because if they didn't hit anything, it would make the German armoured fighting vehicle move out or move on, so that you knew that you could probe forward a bit further and he wouldn't actually be keeping you in his sights. And on one occasion of rest, when we pulled back for, I think, 4 or 5 days, we even went to a 2nd Tactical Air Force landing strip and had a word with these sergeant pilots to tell them how much we appreciated them. We did have to take precautions that they didn't actually hit us, because, I mean, sometimes the distance between us and the Germans might only have been 800 to 2,000 yards, which is not a lot in flying time. So we did have to put out signals of either if we had asked for a tactical airstrike, we had to put out big orange sheets across the engine deck at the back, and when in fact we could hear the Typhoons or see them circling overhead, we'd let off orange smoke so that they knew, you know, that they didn't have to drop it on us. But they were, I would say, exceptionally good, the Typhoon, the 2nd Tactical Air Force, in giving you quick support. Now, to get that support, you might have to wait 2 hours, but you were more than happy to wait concealed for 2 hours and not having to move forward until the Typhoons had a go at moving the opposing tank in front of you. And was the fact that one German tank could hold up a whole regiment. It could stop a whole regiment of 57 Sherman tanks from moving because it was well concealed. It had got its gun sights exactly on marks. It could open fire at 2,000 yards, which is a long distance, a mile. And it could pick off, you know, Sherman tanks at 2,000 yards when our own 75mm couldn't even think of engaging a German tank in under 800 yards to 1,000 yards. So you had this situation where one or two German tanks, you know, with their high-velocity 75 and 88mm guns, could stymie the advance of a whole armoured regiment and a whole armoured brigade. Until such time as another squadron could make a flanking move around where you thought they were, or until the 2nd Tactical Air Force could do something, or, as happened more frequently, each armoured brigade had a company of Royal Artillery on chassis units. So the Royal Horse Artillery, if you could get them up and they weren't engaged, could come up very, very quickly with their 25-pounder tracked vehicles and lay down a very quick and effective artillery stonk on a wood that would be enough to move the opposition and allow you to sort of get forward into a better firing position.
So what was your attitude towards the German enemy in Normandy?
One of great respect, I think. Because the regiment, I mean, whether it's the 3rd County London Yeomanry or the 44th Royal Tank Regiment, had been fighting for 3 years up to that point. And they were very circumspect about the German army. And again, one of these curious contrasts, ironies, is that you thought that they were so good, the German army, because they had exceptionally good weapons, like their tanks, but which were good for defensive operations rather than offensive, their mortar fire and their small arms. But when we came to the Falaise Gap, you suddenly realised that 80% of it was horse-drawn transport. And it seemed to be a curious mixture that, yeah, the British Army and most of the Western armies were totally mechanised, and the German Army was still relying on lots of horse-drawn transport. So they had this curious mixture of very, very effective weapons in very, very well-disciplined fighting units, where a German battle group of Panzer Grenadier infantry and Panzer units could form a very effective stopping point to much more, you know, much greater numbers of opponents. So nobody took any chances that the German army was asleep at any time. And it was mostly, you know, very, not cautious to a degree, but just very, very circumspect that you didn't let anything, you didn't take anything for granted that you know, the Germans weren't looking at you at that particular moment.
Were they superior soldiers to ours?
I think they had different motivation. They had different motivation. We were democracy, and it's rather difficult actually to find in a democracy what you're fighting for. But the Germans had this indoctrination of fighting for the fatherland. Yes, I think they were highly motivated, most of them. Not the conscripted Lithuanians and all sorts of other low-grade infantry or pioneer battalions. No, they didn't do anything at all. But the Panzer units were very good. And they were good because they had faith in their weapons.
Did you come across German troops on a personal basis in the form of prisoners?
Oh, yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
Can you describe the circumstances under which that would happen?
Well, they would, obviously, if you were if you were moving into a German infantry position that luckily hadn't got armour to help it, then after a lot of letting off rounds at not only 75mm high explosive into infantry positions, but lots of machine gun rounds, if they came forward with a white flag, well, that was it. They came forward. Obviously, they looked pretty miserable. Anybody, I think, looked pretty miserable. But they were not, they were invariably quite well turned out and quite smart. So I think there were obviously lots of prisoners who were very, very miserable, the lower grade ones, but I think if you had any number of prisoners, then those who were in the Panzer units, either in vehicles or on foot, you could see that they were a higher calibre. Mm.
Did you ever come across the maltreatment of prisoners?
No. We heard that maltreatment took place after they had got back into the POW cages.
Of what kind?
Well, I think if they had things like watches and wallets and that, they were removed as... And that's nothing unusual amongst the soldiery. They've taken as part and parcel of the... I think, yes, we did relieve prisoners of their watches, particularly if they were German army issue watches. And yes, that did happen. But I didn't see any physical maltreatment. They were treated. The booty was taken to be a legitimate part of what was going on. But no, nothing else.
Now, if we can pick up the narrative, I think the last thing you were talking about was the failure to hurl that beachhead, as it were, across the
Odon. Well, it's hazy recollections now, and in fact, some of what I say is only because I've read about it subsequently. But when you're inside the tank, you don't always know. You know you crossed the River Odon, you see it, but you don't know quite where you are on the other side. You don't even know the names of villages that you might bypass, because if you're looking through a gunner's periscope, you have quite a limited vision range, and you're not thinking of your immediate surroundings. You're only thinking about whether you've got a round in the gun. You're trying to remember, was there one place there? Is it ready to fire? Or you're sort of wondering whether you're going to traverse your turret by hand or whether you're going to put it on the power traverse. And there's a lot of noise going on. The engine's running and it's moving and clanking forward. So the recollections across